Success is something that every person strives for. I have not found an exception to this yet. Sure, we define success differently, person to person, and we probably pursue different methods in order to succeed, but every person wants to succeed in the task that they apply themselves to. Whether you're cooking a meal, whether you're preaching a sermon, whether you're writing a business plan, whether you're planting a garden, you want what you're doing to work, and you don't want your efforts to be in vain. And we see this in Nehemiah, a man who had a project, a man who had a vision, and he wanted desperately to succeed. And he believed that if he could lead the people of God to rebuild the walls of Jerusalem and the gates of Jerusalem, that God would be honored. Well, those of you who know how this story goes, how it ends, you'll know that Nehemiah succeeds in his effort. The walls of Jerusalem, the gates of Jerusalem are rebuilt. But it was not an easy project. It was not an easy journey for Nehemiah. So we retrace his steps this morning, looking to Nehemiah as an example as to how we accomplish difficult tasks. Now, we've noted from the very outset of this mission message series that Nehemiah has been constant in prayer. Nehemiah is a very capable man, an intelligent man, a hard-working man. But before he applies himself in any way to this task, he comes before God in earnest prayer. This was his instinctive response to hearing the news of the dreadful state of Jerusalem. He did not initially say, "Oh, I'll go and fix this." His initial response was to weep and to bow before the one who could fix all of this. Even in the presence of King Artaxerxes, with his knees buckling beneath him, Nehemiah writes that before making any request of the king, "I pray to the God who rules from heaven." If you read that in chapter 2, verse 4, Nehemiah, even in the presence of the king, takes a moment to pray. Because he was a man of prayer. He was a man of faith. And because the presence of faith does not justify the absence of organization, Nehemiah was also engaged in good planning. We talked last Sunday about how followers of Jesus sometimes err on one extreme or the other. On one extreme, we say God will fix it. God will work all things out according to His purposes. God will cause all things to work together for good. And so we leave it all up to God and do nothing. That's one erroneous extreme. The other extreme is to believe it all depends on me. It all depends on my efforts and my abilities. But we see here in Nehemiah a blessed combination of faith and determination. The man who prayed also planned. The man who wept before God also worked for God. Nehemiah had thought through what it would take for his vision to succeed, for reconstruction to be completed. So he approached the right person, the king, and he asked for permission. He was able to articulate all that it would be necessary to fulfill the plan. He knew he would need letters for traveling, the ancient equivalent of a passport. He knew he would need letters, requisition forms, in order to get the necessary building materials. Nehemiah was a man of prayer, but he was also a very good planner. And for the follower of Jesus, let us not be one or the other, but let us pursue both. Well, we pick up our text this morning in the middle of Nehemiah chapter 2, and we see that Nehemiah's prayers and Nehemiah's plans have landed him safely in Jerusalem, which you'll remember from previous messages is more than 800 miles away from where he was working as cupbearer for the king. Now, I don't know about you, but I find it interesting that in Nehemiah's narrative, following his interaction with the king, the narrative does not resume until 3 days after he's already arrived in Jerusalem. Now, maybe I'm just thinking this through with a modern mindset. I'm imagining this story of Nehemiah being made into a major motion picture that we can go see at the theater. And I imagine that if I was directing this film on Nehemiah, I would make a big deal about the journey. The 800-mile journey and all the obstacles and all the dangers and toils and snares. Then I would want to make a big deal about the arrival in Jerusalem. The jewel of his eye, Jerusalem, the promised land. I would make a big deal about his arrival. Nehemiah says nothing. He picks up the narrative 3 days after his arrival. Why is this? Well, I can only conclude that Nehemiah omitted much information because it was not immediately relevant to the pursuit and implementation of his vision. In other words, probably a lot of really neat things happened that would have been cool details to record, but the cool details would have distracted us from the real mission. No doubt interesting things happened to Nehemiah between Susa and Jerusalem, but he was far too focused on the vision to record them. It seems if it wasn't related to reconstruction, if it wasn't related to the restoration of God's people, Nehemiah was not going to waste his parchment on this information. As I stand before you this morning, I think we would benefit from a similar kind of focus. Whether we're talking about pursuing the vision for St. Andrew's Presbyterian Kirk, or the vision you have for your career, or the vision you have for your family, you will benefit by eliminating those things that do not contribute to the progress of your vision. Howard Hendricks says it very well. He says, "There are many things I can do, but I have to narrow it down to the one thing I must do. The secret of concentration is elimination." Isn't that true? I just think of my own prayer life. As I bow before the Lord in prayer, the struggle I have in focusing on Him are the myriad of things that are calling for my attention. And the only way I can focus appropriately on prayer, on the Lord, is to eliminate those other things. So we need to focus our efforts on those things that will advance us in Christ-likeness and give us progress with the transformation of our community. So here we have, if the first two steps in pursuing this vision is to pray to God about it and then to make plans about it, here in chapter 2, in the middle of chapter 2, we get a third and fourth step. And again, think about all the information that Nehemiah has omitted. And we're going to see some pretty monotonous detail, but I think important detail if we read verses that follow verse 11. Nehemiah says, "I got up during the night and left my house." Doesn't seem too interesting to me. "I took some men with me without telling them what I thought God wanted me to do for the city. The only animal I took was the donkey I rode on." Again, these are seemingly irrelevant details. But he goes on, "I went through the valley gate on the west, then past the dragon spring before coming to the garbage gate. As I rode along, I took a good look at the crumbled walls of the city and the gates that had been torn down and burned." Restoring Jerusalem's walls was the urgent matter before Nehemiah. But I want us to notice that there's no sense in which Nehemiah acted in haste. I'm so impressed that Nehemiah was not in a hurry. He had traveled 800 miles. You'd think he'd get right to it. But we don't even get the narrative resuming until 3 days after his arrival. And then the first action scene is him riding around on a pony in the middle of the night, just having a good look at the walls that had been burned down, something he already knew about. But then I look at Nehemiah's phrase, "I took a good look." I took a good look. It's rendered in another translation as I inspected. And I need to tell you that this is a Hebrew word that is a medical term that Nehemiah uses. It's a medical term to describe the probing of a wound in order to see the extent of the damage. So you can imagine my delight when I read this and I find out I've got another P word. I've got prayer. I've got planning. What's going to be my next P word? Probing. That if we are to pursue a vision, we need to have a good look at what needs fixing. We need to inspect our context. We need to probe and to examine what is necessary. The value of careful inspection is illustrated in perhaps a fictional story, but definitely an unverified story about the legendary artist Michelangelo. Michelangelo was working on one of his most significant projects, and a prince came to visit him in his studio. And he found Michelangelo sitting in front of an 18-foot block of marble, just staring at it. And so the prince then knew that the rumors were true. It had been circulated that Michelangelo had been coming to his studio every single day and sitting and staring at this block of marble without doing anything, and then going home and having dinner. So the prince asked the artist, "What are you doing?" Michelangelo turned to him and said, "Sto lavorando. I'm working." And 3 years later, that block of marble would become the statue of King David. So you see there in the example of Michelangelo, the value of sitting and probing and inspecting and calculating and understanding the context. I know as a Canadian now living in the Bahamas, for me, how true this has been. In so many ways, I feel like I've been fumbling in the dark. People say, "Oh, Bryn, we really appreciate this that you're doing or that what you're doing." And if they ask me anything about my strategy, I'm at a loss. I feel like a guy riding around on a pony just trying to figure out what's going on and how I might fix things. I resonate with this example of Nehemiah, someone who didn't rush into doing a million things, but took some time to have a hard look, to inspect, to probe, to assess, to calculate. Now, an outside observer might say Nehemiah was procrastinating. He was just riding around on a pony, not doing a whole lot. I saw him. I woke up in the middle of the night to get some water. Saw this guy riding around on a pony. He wasn't doing very much. I hope this guy isn't our leader. I mean, we don't know what the people were thinking. They might have thought he was procrastinating, but we know how the story ends, so we know that this is very intentional, that this probing is a part of the hard work that Nehemiah was doing. He prayed, he planned, and he probed. And in keeping with alliteration in my using of the letter P, he then came to the point when he had to present the vision. Because up until this point, it really was just Nehemiah's vision. And that's what I've been saying for three weeks. Nehemiah's vision, Nehemiah's vision. There comes a point in time where every individual who dreams up a vision has to get others to buy in. The vision needs to be accepted or received or imparted to other people. And so after Nehemiah has been much in prayer, much in planning, diligent in probing, it comes time for him to present his vision. There came a time when the vision he had for restoration would need to be owned by his fellow Israelites. And to this end, Nehemiah presents his vision to the people of Jerusalem. And I love how one translation puts it. Nehemiah basically begins by identifying the problem, which I think is a good way to present any vision. Because if people think that nothing's broken, then they won't have any aspiration to fix it. So Nehemiah begins, as many of us would, he identifies the problem. He says, "Jerusalem's a mess." That's the rendering of the contemporary English version. Now, Nehemiah is stating the obvious. Everyone living in and near the city of Jerusalem knew it was a mess. Why would Nehemiah begin his presentation in this way? Did you know Jerusalem's a mess? Yes, we've seen it, Nehemiah. Thanks for traveling all this way to tell us what we already knew. Why does he do it? There's a lady in my first congregation, a lovely, lovely, older lady, and she's now gone to be with the Lord. And she lived in a tiny house in rural Ontario. And I know that we have varying levels of tidiness and messiness, and some of us are pack rats, and some of us, you know, throw things out. But this sweet older lady, she had so much stuff in her little home that you couldn't walk two people side by side anywhere in this home. I mean, just books and things piled upon heaps on heaps on things. Anytime he wanted to go sit somewhere, he had to move stuff. And it got me wondering, well, I knew that she didn't have many visitors. And I wonder if it got to the point where that she lived with the mess for so long, it wasn't a mess to her. It was an organized structure, an organized way of living. I think maybe the danger for the people living in Jerusalem is they had gotten used to the walls being destroyed. They'd gotten used to not having the gates as they once were. There is a temptation, I think, for all of us, if there's something broken in our life, if there's something that's amiss in our life, we can get used to it, become accustomed to it. So Nehemiah tries to wake them up. Jerusalem is a mess, and we need to do something about it. I want you to notice something about the method that Nehemiah uses for getting people to support the vision. I love how Nehemiah includes himself in the predicament. Look at the language he uses here. Because I have met leaders, more than I wish to number, I have met leaders who constantly want to distance themselves from the problems of their organization. I have seen leaders who've said to their people, "You need to do better than that. You need to change that. You need to shape up. You need to fix this." Nehemiah had been living 800 miles away, and he refuses to detach himself from taking responsibility for the predicament. Listen to the language. "You see the bad situation we are in." The bad situation we are in. Those of us who are called to lead would be well served if we followed Nehemiah's example of employing "we" language instead of "you" language. I don't do a lot of marriage counseling, and when I do, it's pretty basic. I have some simple tools and resources that I've accumulated along the way, but one of the simplest pieces of advice that I give to couples who are struggling is I ask them, I encourage them to eliminate the word "you" from their vocabulary. Because it's my experience that in a marriage relationship, the word "you" is most often used as an accusatory word or a judgmental word. "You always do this. You never do that." That's not Nehemiah's approach. Nehemiah always uses the language of "we." The language of "you" divides people. The language of "we" unites people. And Nehemiah realized the people would need to be united in their efforts. And I love how the New American Standard Bible records the people's response. They respond to Nehemiah's language and to his methods of leadership, and they say to one another, "Let us arise and build. Let us arise and build." So they put their hands to the good work. We've got a vision here, St. Andrew's Presbyterian Kirk. We want to become more like Jesus Christ. And we want that becoming like Christ to benefit other people. We want it to help transform the community in which we live. And in order to advance that vision, we must pray. We must plan. We must probe. And we must present to one another the vision over and over again. The progress of Nehemiah's vision had come a long way on the back of those four steps. And the people had now signed on and they're ready to do the work. And the subsequent Sundays, this is going to get exciting because they're actually doing the work. And they get all kinds of opposition. But we'll leave that for another Sunday. But I don't want us to miss the profundity of this aspect. It's not as if Nehemiah rolled into Jerusalem and there are a bunch of people standing around with their hands in their pocket with nothing to do. This was an agricultural society. And in an agricultural society, if you don't work, you don't eat. These people weren't standing around with nothing to do. They were up to their eyeballs with things to do. They were feeding their families. The people of Israel were put low in society, and they were trying to rise up and look after themselves and one another. Jerusalem was such a mess that a lot of people were moving out. They lived in the suburbs, you could say. They didn't want to live downtown Jerusalem where all the crime was, where all the danger was. So they pushed to the outside. So if they were going to join in Nehemiah's vision, they would need to leave the suburbs and set up camp right in the middle of Jerusalem. If they're going to join Nehemiah's vision, they're going to have to sacrifice some of their own luxuries and even necessities and put their hands to the work set before them. Joining in on Nehemiah's vision would require great sacrifice. But I look at this text, and if there was any hesitation with these people, you don't see it. Rebuilding the walls of Jerusalem apparently became a huge priority for the people of Israel. Now we need to draw this into present day as we close here this morning. And I realize we cannot make a perfectly clean comparison between ancient Jerusalem and modern day Nassau. But I think we can imagine some things in common that are not right with Nassau, or at the very least, some things that could use improving. I think we would all agree that we are alarmed by the increase in crime in this country. And we continue to feel the burden of those who live in impoverished conditions. No, we're not in ruins, not physically, not even spiritually. So in that sense, we differ from Jerusalem. But would it be true to say that Nassau is in need of transformation? Does anything need to change in this country? And would it be true to say that the Kirk has something meaningful to contribute toward this transformation? Would you agree that the Kirk has something meaningful to contribute to the changes that might occur in this city and in this nation? If Nehemiah can do it, we can do it. If Nehemiah and his millions of obstacles can be overcome, we can overcome the things that stand in our way. And if pursuing Christ-likeness is God's idea, if transforming this community is God's idea, then God will help us. He will be our strength and our shield, our ever-present help in times of trouble. Therefore, we will not fear. If God be for us, who can be against us? If this vision that we've dreamed up and put on a screen once in a while is really God's vision, then we will surely succeed. I don't know what your current circumstances are. Some of you are probably sitting here today thinking, I'm up to my eyeballs and things. I'm just struggling to look after my own home. I can't imagine transforming a nation. If that's how you're feeling, I suspect that's normal. And I suspect that's probably how the people in Nehemiah's day felt as well. But they were motivated by a dignified work. A work of restoration. A work of transformation. A work that would honor their God. So I urge you this morning, whatever your circumstances, find a way to get in on this, where you and we are pursuing Christ-likeness and community transformation. It's a good work. It's the right thing to do. It's the right place to invest our energies. And quite frankly, I think it's what we're here for. I believe that's why God has put us in this place at this time. It's not to build our own kingdoms, but to build His kingdom. To see His will done on earth as it is in heaven. To this end, let us arise and rebuild this nation. Let us put our hand to this noble work. In Jesus' name, amen.